16th of January. We are interviewing Rabbi Walter Jacob. We're on tape 8, side 16. We are also in the retired Rabbi Jacob's office, which is the old Victor Cavalier office. It's slightly smaller, and we've been told that it's going to take a little while to be completely moved in. But it's very nice. It's kind of cozy.
Let me just add that everything is here that's going to be here except the furniture, which hasn't come.
Okay.
And the bookshelves are completely new and much higher because I needed every inch of space that I could possibly get. I moved in on the last of the year. Did everything except one thing which I forgot to move, and I had to go back on the 1st of January and do it.
What is that?
I forgot to move my telephone messages.
How can you live without them? Walter, we left off the last time that we, I think it was sometime in November, when we last interviewed you, and we had pretty much finished the story of Horizon Home, but we went to the point where you had children from 4 to 12, and then you said that the admission for older children, which was limitless, occurred. And what does, how does that translate?
Well, what happened was that as we moved along, we saw that one site was not going to be enough, and so expanded to other sites, not contiguous, but in other parts of the city, because the whole idea is to scatter the population so that there is no population pressure in any one area. It's more difficult to administer, but it works out well practically. And slowly began admitting first children who were older, and then as the children grew up, because we had a policy that we would not ever simply dismiss somebody without having an appropriate site, we decided to change some of our sites to adults. And that's what they are now. And the effort has been, and pretty much successful, that everybody moves out of the houses where they live during the day. Some are sufficiently skilled to move to jobs or even to ride a bus on their own. And others go to sheltered workshops, and there's transportation arranged. And they all do some kind of work which provides some sort of satisfaction.
So it's a halfway house, what you're saying.
No, it's not a halfway house, because they will always remain
stay there. Okay.
In this setting.
And how many people? I think you mentioned you have like 8 satellites with Horizon Home. How many?
There are about 80 people involved on a permanent basis, and another dozen or so on a rotating basis, respite for families who need care for a short time while either they're on vacation or some family emergency has occurred, something like that.
And the staff, do you have any idea what the rate?
I don't know what the staff number is at the moment, but it's about one staff person to every 3 people, because now that sounds very high, but you have to remember that you have to have staff 24 hours a day.
Okay.
There's always a good bit of turnover too, because the people simply get worn out. It's difficult. Some of the people, autistic children and adults, for example, are hard to deal with, as are some other individuals. The directorship has not changed too often. I think we've had in 25 years, is it close to 25 years, perhaps 3 directors. You know, that kind of data one can get separately, but I don't have it at my fingertips.
We have the name of the first one, and I was just curious.
And the name of the current one is Jim Kirk.
Okay.
And he has been there for quite a while, and is very skillful on many different levels. And of course, as we moved along, we found that we had, I think I mentioned this last time, we had to change from a highly a home-like setting the home-like setting remains, but a home-like treatment for staff to keeping detailed records. If you want to fire somebody, you have to have long records of having warned them appropriately. And things like, simple things like, we never had in our regulations that you cannot smoke pot on the job. We took that for granted. And now you had to have all these things down on a piece of paper.
Yeah, that is on the last tape, right?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, who succeeded Ron Williams?
I don't remember. I'll have to look that up.
I would appreciate that.
Okay.
All right. I just wanted to mention something, just for the record, because Mina Cavalier did play a role in the community, that I could write this in my notes, but I thought maybe you'd mention she was also president of the National Council.
Okay. You mean as far as the room goes?
No, it's just her career. You mentioned Mina Cavalier as you talked about Victor.
Okay.
When people's names are mentioned.
All right, sure. That's
okay.
Fine. Yes, yes, and we've been friends for a long time.
Okay.
And she also taught in the religious school here.
Right.
And was active in the sisterhood.
Right. Okay, now I think we have to talk about the response that we do not have. First of all, we have to assume that I had to go to Random House to the dictionary because I don't know in detail, and certainly details what you'll do. We do not have on tape. We talk about the response, and you talk about your secretary being very good, and you are also on the board. Could you, because we need this on tape, what is the response? And later on, unless I remind you, you're involved.
Okay, let's talk about that. Responsa is the, you might say, the leading form of the development of Jewish law, and in that way of really one of the one or two major tracks of Judaism through the centuries. Instead of developing legal codes, which is possible for a legislative body, because you don't have either a legislative body and you don't have any group of Jews in any particular country that make up large numbers. This Jewish law, in other words, the way Jewish life is supposed to move, has developed through questions and answers, which anyhow is a more practical approach. So a question is asked of a rabbi. If he feels, and I'm using he because we're talking about past centuries, if he feels that he can answer it, he will answer it. If he feels that he cannot answer it, he will find somebody else whom he trusts to answer it. Then that answer is not just an oral answer, but is written down, and tries always to use the traditions of the past, which means other answers and other literature. So those are cited in a responsa. Now, when these responsa accumulate, they are often published and then used by others, or others rebut them and say, well, you know, that answer was provisionally all right, but as we've done more thinking about this question, more research into it, we really need to move into another direction, or perhaps the conditions have changed. Let me give you an example from the Middle Ages. A rabbi asked early in the Middle Ages, when someone had been kidnapped, what kind of ransoming procedure should be used? And an answer was provided which indicated that we ought to keep it down to a reasonable level, we ought to negotiate with the individuals, we ought to see to it that the individual is not harmed, and so on. In the later Middle Ages, when kidnapping became a path of extorting the Jewish community, the answer of one of the great rabbis of that period, who was himself kidnapped, was, we do not ransom, because that simply leads to more of the same. And in his case, they held him, for many years in a castle, which probably was as drafty as the prisons in Peru, and he eventually died there. And then they wanted ransom money for his body. And finally, one rich individual in the community decided to disobey the injunction and paid them the money for the body. But it taught potential kidnappers a lesson. Well, so responsa are deal with the practical day-to-day matters. When there are enough of them, then somebody will go through the whole lot, perhaps for a couple of hundred years, and organize that material along with the other material into a code in which you can easily look up, you know, what are you supposed to do when somebody is kidnapped? What are you supposed to do when your child is going to get married and you really oppose it? How do you deal with all of these very practical problems? So the response in America, in Europe and in Asia, all over the world, this is really the way things were done. Highly decentralized, but amazingly enough, basically a pattern emerges in each generation. In America, the reform movement decided, instead of doing this on an individual basis, the Central Conference of American Rabbis would set up a responsa committee, which it did in 1907. Interestingly enough, by the man who was responsible for the Pittsburgh Platform, which says rabbinic Judaism is of secondary importance. Well, by 1907, 20 years later, he found out that it wasn't of quite as secondary importance as he originally had said. And so this committee started answering questions. He was the first chairperson. And there was a whole series of other chairs after that. Not too many questions came to the committee in the first 40 years or so. More questions came beginning with the Second World War as people became more interested both in the details of observance and wanted some answers. And also as they wanted a view on current questions which did more to combine the tradition with modernity. And so Dr. Freehoff, who was chair of the responsa committee right after the Second World War, wrote a number of books on this, and in the end, in his lifetime, wrote about 500 responsa. I took over the committee in 76. I'm not quite sure of that. But that I can check. Headed it then for till 1990. May have been 1974. Somewhere in that neighborhood. Does the biography, it would say that somewhere here? Maybe not.
I couldn't find it. It's just here.
No, that's bibliography.
The only mention of the responsa is in the
bibliography. No. Current national offices and boards, past national offices and boards. Well,
chair. I scanned through it and couldn't find it. I might have missed it.
All right, it doesn't matter. I can discover that easily enough. Chairman of the responsa committee, 1976 to 1990. Okay. Now, how does that work? In that position, you have a committee and you try to get them involved in reacting to the responsa that you write. At first, Dr. Freehoff didn't use a committee at all. He was even more adverse to committees than I. So at first I circulated every responsa to the committee. They soon said, we'd rather not be bothered that often. So then I'd circulate only those that I considered important. And the number of questions rose steadily, so that in my 14 years as chair, I wrote over 500 responsa.
Can you give us an example of some questions that were asked?
Well, I can read you. You can look at any of these tables of contents.
Okay.
The disabled rabbi, insanity in criminal cases. When is abortion permitted? Dangerous medical experiments. In vitro fertilization. Teenager and conversion, the homosexual convert, autopsies for future knowledge, Alzheimer's disease, drugs and mystical experiences, medical use of psychedelic drugs, burial of non-Jews, open caskets, burial of human skin, all kinds of things about non-Jews in a Jewish community or in a Jewish service, adultery and marriage, vasectomy, parental obligations to severely retarded children, everything under the sun, you know. And I left out most of the kind of liturgical style questions. Well, how do you, a menorah, is there a particular form for a menorah, or that kind of thing, which to me is of much lesser interest. So what happened was that you write the responsa, now you have to ask, who's going to listen to them? Certainly the person who asks the question is going to take what you say seriously.
There were some of the people that asked.
Otherwise they wouldn't have asked them. Hundreds of rabbis and lay people all over the country. And so you never know when you pick up the telephone, because that's the way these things happen nowadays. And it still happens. Although I'm not chair, I continue to write responsa individually.
And you don't dismiss a question? Or is the question then weighed and evaluated, whether it's...
No, it's... every question deserves an answer. Sometimes you can simply give an answer over the telephone real fast, or refer them published three books on this, to one of the books, because most people have not bothered to look at the book before they call you. That's the current American way. And continue to write responses. So, for example, one of the last ones, which will appear next week in this little publication, Halacha, is on war games and Judaism. Now, we're not talking about an army's war games, but the computer war games. A teenage group and a youth group have started playing these war games. What's our attitude toward that? That's one kind of question. Another, which I just sent off to Germany, is what basis is there for diversity in a single Jewish community? How does that play out in history and in Jewish law? Or another one, quite recent, was what kind of priority should there be in charitable giving? Now, how do you Jewishly prioritize, not only at the giving end, but also at the other end, in charitable distributions? So these deal with everything under the sun, and often with very, very difficult social questions, as well as just simple ritual questions. As somebody else is chairing the committee now, much of the committee work is done by email, but I write them individually, less than before, about one every 2 weeks, something like that. I used to do them about at the rate of about one a week. And it's a lot of work, because often you get questions about an area about which you know very little or nothing.
Do research.
And then you may find a reference, and you may spend 10 hours checking it, tracing it down. and then find out it really is irrelevant. So you spend 10 hours doing nothing but broadening your basic knowledge. And the wall of books behind you there, Gavi, are response to literature.
Oh, my goodness. Now, when you say tracing down, do you eventually go back to Leviticus?
Well,
is that the base? Is that our constitution in a loose sense?
Sometimes, but very often there is no real biblical base. You know, there is a vague biblical statement. Usually there's something Talmudic, but what's more important are the things that happened after the Talmud. You know, you find out that you're trying to deal with a question that surely has been dealt with before, but not in exactly the same way. I'm writing an essay now on, it's part of a book on marriage and obstacles to marriage. And what I'm doing are the other types of relationships which are akin to marriage. So, for one thing, concubines. Another is polygamy. Polygamy I'm not going to do very much with, but concubinage, yes. And a third is living together. Now, who has written on living together? It has been dealt with, but you know, you've got to, somebody, let's say, gives you a reference somewhere, and then you look in the book, it isn't there. It's clearly a wrong reference. But that particular person has probably dealt with the issue. Now you have to track it down. The books have no indexes. So you have to, you know, leaf through them, and some of them are not even organized in any sensible fashion. So this can be a long, tedious process.
So they're just published where some of them are privately published? I mean, what, you know, we have the Library of Congress.
Well, the Library of Congress is just a gathering spot.
Right, but so there isn't a gathering spot for the response that published things that have been published? Too?
Well, there is in a sense. The big libraries have major holdings, bigger than mine. I have probably 1,000 volumes.
What is the oldest?
The oldest probably dates to the 1500s, but the problem is that they have only been partially indexed. There is now a computer index to about 200 of these, so that's helpful. But the other, there are perhaps 2,500 such books by different authors. So we've only indexed 10%. I have less than half. So,
is there some consistency in some of the questions that have been asked?
Oh, sure. A given time. No, sure. In every age, people will ask the same questions. And
such as,
when do you say Kaddish? For whom do you say Kaddish? You know, these kinds of things. Well, for that, there's an easy answer. People should just open the Shulchan Aruch, or the rabbi should do that and find the answer. That's easy. But the other questions differ from one age to another. You know, the Holocaust brought a whole series of questions. Plane disasters bring another series of questions. It's endless. I mean, you think that by this time every question would have been answered?
When did it start?
The system started about the year 800. But in a sense, it goes back to the Talmud, because they, you know, throw questions at each other about a given subject. But they didn't formalize it. And about 800-900 in Persia, actually, this was the Islamic caliphate, the Umayyad and Abbasid caliphates, which had an enormous range, and so they included all of North Africa and the whole Near East. the heads of the academies there answered questions for people at a distance and trained their rabbis to send them questions. They kept control that way. But, of course, after a while, the academies, first of all, lost some power, and secondly, mail was not what it used to be, and the answers were too slow in coming, so people started writing answers at a distance.
Since this is a known fact about Judaism, the response, do you get inquiries from other religions, from other people? I mean, is there, what kind of curiosity?
Well, yeah, but that's, you know, that's different. Sure, there are all sorts of questions people call up and ask about Judaism. But these are, you know, internal. And now, what happened with this is that this has led further, because in 1990, when I became a president of the Central Conference, laid this office of responsive committee chair aside, continued, however, in a different fashion. Two of us, Moshe Zemer, Rabbi Moshe Zemer in Israel, and I, here in America, established the Institute of Progressive Halakha, which we then named, as Dr. Frioff died, the Solomon B. Frioff Institute of Progressive Halakha, in his memory. What we do is something a little different. We have symposia on a subject in a specific area. Ask five or six, or as many as eight, leading scholars to do papers on that theme, then publish it, and publish the related responsa or a selection of related responsa along with it. The advantage of that is that instead of having short answers, even a long responsa will run no more than maybe 10 pages, 3,000-4,000 words, something like that. You've now have a collection of pieces on a specific issue. So we are now 6 years old. We've published five books, and the sixth one should be out soon, and seven and eight are more or less on their way. They're on themes like conversion in Jewish law, the fetus and fertility in Jewish law, euthanasia in Jewish law, rabbi and congregant in Jewish law, aging and the aged in Jewish law, that's the next volume. Israel and the diaspora in Jewish law, crime and punishment in Jewish law, that's our series of symposia this year. I've forgotten one, marriage and obstacles to marriage in Jewish law. So those are all either out or in the process of being published. And the advantage is that now you can look, if you're dealing with a theme and you want to know what exists or what opinions exist on that theme, you can find it readily, and it's not the last word, but at least it provides you with some insights that are all collected.
That there's a consensus there.
There may not be a consensus.
Now, all right, euthanasia is something that at this point just sort of jumps out at me because of the Supreme Court issues that are coming up now. So you have the Jewish law or the Jewish response. You now have a government that is addressing the issue of euthanasia. Is that a good coexistence, or is there conflict there, or
well,
how are these things answered?
Let's say
that the Supreme Court now says it's okay to have some assistance in dying, and let's say that
Well, you don't know what the Jewish law says.
Okay. All right. That's what.
And
right.
I'm not going to tell you either, because if you want to do it, you'll have to read the book.
All right.
But there are.
I'm interviewing you now, and I would love. I'd like to have some idea. This is a very relevant subject.
Well,
that's why.
Yeah, but I'm not going to give it to you anyway, because I'm not duty bound to answer every question.
No, you're not.
No, there will be a number of points of view. The importance of this is that it provides a liberal Jewish approach. Orthodox Judaism may have a different approach. But but it's important to see that there's variety, and that all of these views are have a good basis in tradition. That book, for example, has been widely reviewed by Orthodox as well as other reviewers, and in some instances they've become very angry, but that's fine. It has stimulated discussion. That's a good part of this anyway. Well, the whole purpose of this organization, which as you're so interested, you really ought to join.
That would be a coup, wouldn't it?
No, we have about 600 members,